Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, I'll be talking with John Barry, who's celebrating the 20th anniversary of his book, Rising Tide, The Great Mississippi Flood of 1927 and How It Changed America. We'll also hear from Candace Proctor, who writes to C.S. Harris, about her new Regency mystery, Where the Dead Lie. Prize-winning, best-selling historian John Barry is a writer I admire so much, not only for his fine books, so many books we all love, but for his work as an activist for our region. He's the author of Rising Tide, The Great Mississippi Flood of 1927 and How It Changed America, The Great Influenza, The Story of the Deadliest Pandemic in History, and most recently, Roger Williams and the Creation of the American Soul, Church, State, and the Birth of Liberty. Today, we're going to look back at Rising Tide, The Great Mississippi Flood of 1927 and How It Changed America, which is celebrating its 20th anniversary. John Barry, I'm always so happy to welcome you to The Reading Life.
Thanks. It's always a pleasure to be here.
Well, even before its publication 20 years ago, this was a book you thought about for a long time before you started working on it.
That's true. It came out in 97, obviously, 20 years ago. And the idea, I guess, sort of lodged in my mind in 1977. I was down here writing a column for the Vucare Coria, a predecessor sort of Gambit. And there was a special issue on the flood, and it just seemed like this enormous event that someone ought to write about eventually, and just stuck in my mind. It's not that I thought about it for 15 years,
right.
But you know, it was out there in the back of my mind. I had finished my first book and looking for an idea, and this was just there.
And wasn't your office near the river? Didn't you walk along the river a good bit in these
days? A lot of time going to the river when I was here in the 70s. I lived in the quarter, still do, and I went to the river essentially every day. The question I get asked most often is where I got the idea to write it. And I always say, well, growing up in Rhode Island, it was perfectly natural.
Yes.
To want to write. And everybody laughs, as you just did.
Yes.
But the reality is, to me, the river has been so central to American history, it really was natural, even growing up in Rhode Island.
It's a great American romance we have with that river.
It is. And, you know, to me, the river is really something of enormous power. It's not so much the romance, it's the power of the river. That's what fascinates me, and the way it shaped so much of history.
Well, I pulled out my copy of this book, as you know, which is 20 years old. And there are 20-year-old Post-its in it, because that's how I read. And I loved going through the things that caught my attention back then and still do. And one of the things that strikes me looking at these old Post-its is how relevant this book still is to what we're experiencing today.
A little too relevant.
Scary, isn't it? Yeah. It's like we're a divided country. Immigration is still a huge issue. Infrastructure is still a huge issue. Mm-hmm. How our government treats science and scientists. It's really kind of eerie, don't you think?
Well, the more things change, you know.
Yeah, I know, but oh, man.
Yeah, it's disturbing. I agree with you on that. Yeah. But, I mean, obviously, you got to pay some attention to actual science.
Yes.
Every now and then, or it's going to come back and do more than bite you. It will devour you. You know, you started out in the introduction, which I thank you for. That was very kind. I mean, you called me an activist. I don't see myself as an activist, although probably everybody else does.
Yep.
I see myself as a writer. But because of the influenza book, I actually gave a commencement speech at a school of public health once, and I was in preparation for that speech. I was looking at the Code of Ethics of the American Public Health Association, and it's pointed out, and heard this before, but the line was, knowledge is not morally neutral. Sometimes knowledge compels action. And the fact that, as everyone knows, as every scientific study, including those by the oil industry itself, demonstrate, the oil industry is a major contributor to land loss. And I thought it was important to get that information out, which everybody knew, but nobody was talking about.
Well, I mean, this book changed your life in so many ways, starting, I think, with Katrina. And I remember post-Katrina, you emerged as one of the really important voices who understood a lot of what had happened. And I remember you telling me how reluctant you were to be a bestseller again because of that.
Well,
how bittersweet it was.
Yeah, after the storm, the book did very well, and it did kind of bother me. I think in terms of getting involved, the key was that I understood enough about levees that even watching the flyovers during the storm, it looked very suspect to me about how the levees broke, and I started calling people at NOAA, and we're talking about 24, 48 hours after the 17th Street Canal and the other canal levees broke, and asking them what the storm surge was in the lake. And they were very preliminary. And then, frankly, only because I didn't know them, but they knew my book, they wouldn't have taken the phone calls if it weren't for the book. But because of just a tiny bit of research, it became apparent those levees were not overtopped. So within about 72 or 96 hours after the storm, I had pretty much concluded that the levees just collapsed in front of a storm. They were designed to hold. I started telling people that, and that ended up getting me involved and on the levee board and things like that. So that certainly would not have happened had I not written the book, because I wouldn't have understood enough about levees to figure out. Of course, I didn't know why they collapsed, but it was clear that they had just failed.
Were you comfortable in that role of public spokesperson? Did that come easily to you, or was it just that you were so fired up by what had happened?
Well, I think it's incumbent upon everybody, not just writers, to tell the truth as they know it.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, I just was telling the truth. I think somebody had to do it. And, you know, certainly wasn't the only person doing it. I was one of the first on that particular issue. So I don't know that I ever thought about it one way or the other. I had been a member of the press for a long time before
right.
I started writing books. So it wasn't an uncomfortable thing. You know, it was okay.
It was what you had to do.
Yeah,
so tell us a little bit about your work on the levee board and the lawsuit and where things are now and how you feel about it.
Well, as I said, it was clear the oil and gas industry caused significant part of the land loss. Even the American Petroleum Institute did a study that blamed 34% of the land loss on the industry. And there are other studies that put it much higher. Nobody was saying it. So I really felt that the board had to put the truth out there. I confess, when I started this and when the board started, I didn't necessarily think we had a chance in hell of winning. But I did think that if you got the truth out there, the truth itself would be powerful enough to affect change. And now there's no dispute. The truth is out there. Even state legislators who fiercely defend the industry concede that they did at least a third of the damage. But whether that's going to have the power to change things, who knows? The lawsuit was dismissed basically on technical legal grounds. We appealed it to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. They affirmed the dismissal. We are now appealing it to the whole Fifth Circuit. If it loses there, I believe the attorneys will appeal to the Supreme Court. But obviously, that lawsuit is not in a good place. However, as you know, there are other lawsuits out there, the Parrish lawsuits. They probably would not have happened had the levee board not filed. The governor was in the state legislature the strongest supporter of the levee board's lawsuit. He has made clear he expects the industry to come forward and help solve the problem, the part of the problem they created at least. So the ball is rolling. The end result, who knows?
Mm. But one of the things this has done for you is to propel you into this public life. I mean, you're an expert on water resources now. You're an expert on conservation. Did you ever imagine this for yourself?
No, I'm not
as
sure.
A result?
I think people think I know more than I actually do know.
Well,
sometimes
you do.
That's useful. Sometimes that's not so useful. You know, when I write a book, I try to keep doing the research until I think I understand it.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that's pretty quick, and sometimes that takes quite a long while. So I do have a pretty fundamental, decent understanding of most of the issues, not only this book, but on influenza. I was actually probably more involved in national policy making than on floods, you know, on pandemic preparedness. I got very much involved with both the Bush and Obama White Houses on their planning.
And another book that's still relevant, I mean, yeah. And scarily so.
Yeah. So I'm glad that the book, obviously, you know, it's 20 years out there. Most books are long since out of print. And this is still selling, you know, it's not selling tens of thousands of copies, but it's still selling. And that is, you know, very, very pleasing, not because of the pretty small royalty check, but just the fact that people are out there still interested in it. And that's obviously gratifying. In terms of the expertise involved in issues, it kind of sort of drags you back into it, and you can't avoid it. It goes back to that quote that I gave you at the beginning of the interview, that knowledge is not morally neutral, and sometimes it compels action. I think it would be a good thing if everybody recognized that and lived by it, because we all know certain truths, and many of which are important truths, and I think too many of us just let things slide.
Right. So what's your next writing project?
Well, I am doing something I swore I would never do. Fortunately, I never made a public statement that I would never do it. But I am going back. I'm writing about the coast.
Great.
It will include the lawsuit. The book is not exclusively about the lawsuit. But all the things that have caused the coast to disappear, this includes things like 6 dams up on the Missouri River, which I've visited as far away as Montana and the Dakotas, which retain 100 million tons of sediment a year that used to come down here and was available to sustain the landscape. It includes things like the Gulf Intracoastal Waterway, all sorts of man-made interventions which have contributed. As I said, the lawsuit will be in there because the oil and gas industry is a factor, but it's not the only factor.
I can't wait. You know, one of my fondest professional memories is the first time I interviewed you. And
really?
We walked through the quarter, nice. And you showed me the flood gauges.
Which they took down, as a matter
of
fact.
Yes, I know.
There used to be a gauge, basically a yardstick, stuck in the foot of Jackson Square, right by the Natchez Pier. It was never official, but it was pretty accurate. And they took that down, I don't know, 10 years ago. I think probably before Katrina.
Yeah, I always felt very lucky that I got a tour of that from the expert. So thank you for that memory.
You're welcome. I had forgotten all about that.
Oh, we've been talking with John Barry, who's the author of Rising Tide, The Great Mississippi Flood of 1927, and How It Changed America. He'll discuss and sign that book and talk more about its 20-year history Tuesday, March 28th at 6 at Octavia Books. John, thank you so much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Candace Proctor is a Renaissance woman. She's got a PhD in European history. She's been an archaeologist, lived all over the world, and finally settled on writing as her career of choice and New Orleans as her home. She's written scholarly books, thrillers, historical fiction, and has achieved great success with her Sebastian St. Cyr series, mysteries set during the English Regency period. Today, we'll be talking about her most recent, Where the Dead Lie, written under her pseudonym C.S. Harris. Candy, I'm so happy to welcome you back.
It's great to be here. Thank you, Susan.
Now, last time we talked, you were 10 books into the series, and now here we are at number 12. And this one is one of my favorites, but it's very grim. You took on some very grim subjects in this book.
I did. Actually, I got about halfway through it, and I thought, oh dear, maybe this was a mistake, because it really is grittier than most of the other ones are. One of the things that I've always tried to do with this series is to show the contrast between the Regency period that so many readers know, especially through romances, that's the Regency the ball gowns and the carriages and the men in their top hats. And it's a very elegant, very attractive period. But there was another side to the time, which was a time of war and a time when a much larger segment of the population than had been the case was being pressed down into poverty. And it was really grim for them. And so I've always tried to write stories that enabled Sebastian to travel between his society and then the other segments of society that were not as affluent, not as privileged. And so that's what I really wanted to do with this book, was to explore the people who were really on the ragged edge of existence and who were being exploited in a particularly vicious way by the killer, basically,
right.
without giving anything away.
And the victims, I mean, you have a serial killer, and the victims are primarily children.
They're teenagers.
Children.
I couldn't
right,
make them
true.
Too young as a parent. I couldn't go there. So they're 15, 16 teenagers. But of course, teenager wasn't a word that they used at the time.
Of course.
They were still children. They didn't have that concept of, I mean, I guess they used adolescent. So they are young, and they're street children. They're the most vulnerable. It's really quite horrifying to think that these children are still out there, and not just in the developing world, but in our own country, that children who lose their parents or whose living situation is so horrible that they can't stand it anymore, and they run, and they're on their own, and they're very vulnerable. And it's very easy for someone to target them and just basically pull them under, and nobody notices, and even if they do, nobody really cares.
And so many of this underclass, so many people have to turn to crime to survive. And then families get torn apart. There's one family where the mother has been sent off to Botany Bay. And here are these kids left behind.
Yeah, that was something that I discovered when I was living in Australia, was that how many of the convicts sent out there were actually women who were mothers, and their children were left behind. And if you read the stories, these kids, some of them, they literally left the children screaming on the docks while the mothers were rowed out to the transportation ships. And some of those children were just heartbreakingly young. You're talking toddlers, two-year-olds left just screaming on the docks. And sometimes they let the mothers take their children out with them, but a lot of times they were just left on the streets.
Just shocking, shocking. And one of the things that brings us home to the reader now is that Sebastian and Hero are parents and have a young son themselves. So you explore a lot of that change that happens to people when they become parents, their concern for other young people, you know, and children.
I think that once you become a parent, you have a tendency to see your own child in other children. And if you were not sensitive to those vulnerabilities and the need to care for the most vulnerable, I think it develops in you. And it's also, this is a pivotal book in the series because it's also, we see a shift in Sebastian's attitude towards his own father. As his relationship with his own son grows, it affects the way he sees the man who raised him.
Because that's one of the great things about making a long-time investment in a series like this, you know, because you grow to care so much about the characters. And so you always have their timeline going forward, and then you're weaving in all this wonderful historical stuff. Now, I have to say, there's some moments in this book, you have the best names ever. The best names. I will never forget Hector Niebaum. I will never forget him. And Rory Inchbald. I mean, who's like the aging vet, you know, on the street corner. And then the nastiest women named Grace and Hope.
Well, you know, they're nasty. And yet I hope that by the end of the book, people come to see how they became that way.
Yes,
too.
Yes, that's true. So what keeps you going? You've been doing these books a long time. So how far in advance do you plan? What is it that makes you happy? And I assume you are happy when you get up in the morning to work on these books. Because it just shows, I think.
Sometimes I have to admit, I start thinking, you know, when you're setting books in the same place, in the same period, there's always a fear that you're going to run out of characters, you're going to run out of places, you're going to run out of difference, because I like to set scenes in interesting places where interesting things are going on. And I'm wondering, eventually I'm going to run out. I have been doing it a long time. But like you said, one of the things that makes it so fascinating to write a series is to be able to have a character for longer than a book so that you can see him develop through all of it. Because Sebastian has changed so much from when we first met him in January, February of 1811. He was very damaged by his experiences in the war. He wasn't exactly suicidal, but he was at a point where he didn't care if he died. And then we see that he learns that there's all these things he didn't know about his mother and about his father and the woman he was in love with at the time. And then he gets another love and still is exploring all of these things about himself that he didn't know. And it's wonderful to be able to follow a character that has that much richness and depth to him over more than one book. Because I had never written anything besides standalones before I started doing this series.
Oh, wow. So how far ahead are you in your planning?
Well, originally I was thinking I would take the series to Waterloo, but lately I've been thinking maybe that I'll take it up to 1820 when the regent is crowned king. Because the very first book starts with the regent being proclaimed, and I thought that would maybe be a nice kind of an arc to take it through the whole regency period. So I do want to eventually literally end it so that I wrap everything up.
Uh-huh.
So I don't leave readers wondering, well, she never brought this thread to a close or something.
Well, all right. I'm glad. I'm glad you're planning it.
Yeah, so I'm only up to the one I'm writing now is set in April of 1814. So I've still got 6 years left.
All right. I'll follow you along the way. Now, and then in December, in your copious free time, I have no idea when you wrote this, you had a standalone novel come out called Good Time Coming that's a coming-of-age story set in Civil War Louisiana.
Yes.
So what was it like for you to take on a different time period?
That was really wonderful.
Okay.
Because it wasn't only that it was a different time period, but it's a very different character. The main character, Amory, she's a little girl that follows her from when she's like 11 to 15, although most of it takes place when she's 12 and 13, and it's first person. So I do think that writers, when you're doing a series as long as the Sebastian series, you need to occasionally do something else to keep yourself from getting stale.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a book that I had wanted to write for about 10 years, maybe longer. My interest in doing it was spurred by Katrina, ironically, because it was that concept of how do people survive the destruction of their lives, their homes, their mm-hmm. city? Because we came back down a week, literally a week after the hurricane hit, and our house had flooded and lost its roof. So we moved back and we rebuilt the house ourselves because we couldn't hire anyone that early to come right in and do it. And we were living in my mother's house because she didn't flood. And one of the ways I kind of got through it, driving back and forth through this just desolate city, was I kept telling myself that, well, the people of Berlin, they rebuilt, and the Civil War, the people and the destruction. And so a lot of that kind of thinking came through in this book. It was also a book that I always wanted to write to show what the women and children went through in a war. So many books about war, because they're written about men, tend to focus on the experience that the men on the battlefield had. And this is sort of a women's red badge of courage, you know, what they went through, how they held their lives together, especially women in the South, who really were put on a pedestal in a way even that women in the North were not. At the time when women in the North were teachers and nurses, there was still the idea in the South that it wasn't really proper for a lady to do this. And so for these women to suddenly be forced to do all these things that they had never done before just because their men were gone. It was a really fascinating book to write. And I actually wrote it very quickly, I think, because I thought about it for so many years.
That's a sign you were meant to write.
Yeah.
I love your books because the characters are never overwhelmed by history. You know, you do that so skillfully. It's not like you're, let me give you a little lecture about this now. It flows so naturally and so beautifully. Well, I'm definitely hooked on Sebastian and Hero, so I'm glad you're hard at work on the next one. We've been talking with Candace Proctor, who writes the C.S. Harris. You can meet her Tuesday, April 4th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop when she discusses and signs Where the Dead Lie. Candy, thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Today's guest, John Barry, presents Rising Tide, the 20th Anniversary Lecture, Tuesday, March 28th at 6 at Octavia Books. Elizabeth Pierce discusses and signs her book, Drink Dat New Orleans, a guide to the best cocktail bars, dives, and speakeasies, Tuesday, March 28th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Octavia Books presents novelist Taylor Brown, whose new book is River of Kings, in conversation with novelist Katie Simpson Smith, Thursday, March 30th at 6 at Octavia Books. Celebrate the 350th anniversary of John Milton's Paradise Lost with a marathon public reading, Friday, March 31st through April 2nd, from 1 to 5 at Milton Ladder Library. If you're interested in being a reader, email milton.at.ladder@gmail.com. Kathleen Schrenk discusses and signs her middle grade novel, A Dog Steals Home, Saturday, April 1st from 11:30 to 1 at Maple Street Bookshop, and then again Tuesday, April 4th from 9 to 1 at the Crescent City Farmers Market in Uptown Square, where Broadway meets a river. That's at an LASPCA off-site adoption event. Diane de las Casas and John Corre signed their new children's book, Captain Deadeye, Sunday, April 2nd at 2 at Octavia Books. Claudia Gray debuts her new YA novel, Defy the Stars, Tuesday, April 4th at 5 at Octavia Books. Today's guest, C.S. Harris, signs Where the Dead Lie, Tuesday, April 4th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Tulane University and the Dayton Literary Prize present a discussion, Bridge to Understanding, a discussion of systemic racism in America, moderated by Bernice McFadden and featuring former recipients of the Dayton Literary Prize. Margaret Rinkle, author of Wash, Wilbert Rito, author of In the Place of Justice, A Story of Punishment and Deliverance, and Gilbert King, author of The Devil in the Grove, Thurgood Marshall, The Groveland Boys, and The Dawn of a New America. That's Tuesday, April 4th from 6 to 8 at the Woldenberg Arts Center at Tulane. The New Orleans Museum of Art is issuing a call for poets in grades 8 through 12 for their free poetry workshop. That's led by Broad Bagard at the museum Saturday, April 8th from 10 to 4. Participants will tour the museum, select a work of art that inspires them, then write a poem that they can submit to NOMA for publication in a book. For more information, contact Sheila Cork, librarian at NOMA, at 504-658-4117 or scork@noma.org. An edible book day is coming up at the New Orleans Museum of Art Friday, April 7th. Demonstrate your love of books, baking, and art. Local community groups and individuals are invited to bake and decorate cakes inspired by books. Here's the schedule. Cake setup takes place at 4:30. Judging and People's Choice ballots start at 5:30. There'll be a cake decorating demo at 6:30 in the NOMA Cafe. Then the awards are announced at 7. Start baking your book cakes, people. Also coming up soon, the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities celebrates its annual Bright Lights Award dinner, honoring the Humanist of the Year, William Joyce, and many others. Thursday, April 13th at 7 at the Shaw Center for the Arts in Baton Rouge. Check out leh.org for tickets. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.